You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Knepper, and today we'll be talking to Pete Croato about his book, From Hang Time to Prime Time, Business, Entertainment, and the Birth of the Modern Day NBA. Pete has been published in many news outlets, including the New York Times and Slam Magazine. This is Pete's first book. Pete, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. I wonder if you could start us off by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, certainly. I've been a freelance writer since 2006. Before then, kind of had a circuitous route to get to freelance writing and sports writing. I graduated in 2000 from the College of New Jersey, graduated with a degree in journalism, professional writing. And after that, I spent a calamitous year as a news reporter for the Courier News in Bridgewater, New Jersey. It's a Gannett paper. At the time, had about 40,000 circulation. So I was the Hunterdon County reporter there. So basically, I had to cover 500 square mile county on my own. So that was a real toboggan ride. So I did that for a year until I couldn't take it anymore. My editors couldn't take it anymore. So I quit kind of in frustration. And after that, I spent two years working in bookstores. I worked at a bookstore called Pyramid Books in Metuchen, New Jersey, which is no longer there. Then I went to Borders and was freelancing a little bit. Then I spent 3.5, almost 4 years working for a trade publication in East Brunswick, New Jersey, called VRM Inc. And that still covers the natural products industry. So that covers vitamins, supplements, things like that. So I did that for 3.5 to 4 years, and I was part of an editorial staff of three that put out 28 magazines a year. So 20 issues a year over three magazines. So it was just a lot of work, but it taught me how to write long features. It taught me how to do a lot of things on my own because there was not a lot of help. It was it was really intense. So we all had to pitch in. So I was answering phones, ordering office supplies, and writing like 3 2,000 word articles a month on top of editing, you name it. So after a while, as you might imagine, that got to be pretty, pretty intense and pretty draining. So I was about to turn 30, and I thought, I feel like I'm not really doing as much as I should. I feel like I'm leaving something on the table. So I talked about it with my family. I thought about it long and hard, and I just wasn't happy. So I decided to leave. I didn't have any writing job lined up, but I did have a bookselling job lined up at Borders in East Brunswick, which is where I lived, which is where the magazine was based. So I decided to quit my job, work at Borders, and try freelancing. So 14 years later, here I am, having written a book and now writing for some outlets that, quite frankly, can't believe I'm writing for. So it's been a real journey to get here. Like there really wasn't a straight line for me. Like there was no rocket ship to the moon. It was just, I would say, a series of failed launches until finally, you know, I reached some sort of orbit. Where I am, I have no idea, but I think I'm in the air at this point. It's a 14 year journey from, or not actually, no, wow, 20 years, pardon me, to get from college to the book coming out.
Right. Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So of course this book is about the kind of the explosion of the NBA and, mm-hmm. and mostly the 1980s. I wonder if you could kind of set the scene for our listeners by telling them a little bit about the state of the NBA in say the late 70s.
Yeah, the NBA in the late 70s was really it was a sport that was in trouble. It had a big image problem, and part of it was, I think, the social attitudes of Americans. They were, you know, it was the NBA as it is now was a predominantly black sport. That made a predominantly white television audience very uncomfortable. It also, the league also had a big problem with, this went on in the 1980s with whether it was real or perceived. A lot of the players were thought to be on drugs, and that was I think a lot of Americans were not particularly keen on watching a sport with featuring men who they were not familiar with, who were not part of their everyday life, who may have had, may have been, on drugs. But it wasn't only that. I'm simplifying the point. The NBA also was a sport that didn't really have any characteristics. If you think of Major League Baseball, there is this aura behind it. It is America's pastime. It is a game that, your grandfather watched on the, or listened to on the radio with Red Barber, calling the games, or Harry Carey, or whomever. I mean, there was a tradition there. It grew up in cities. It was played in ball fields and open fields. And football had this reputation because of television, of being sort of, of increasingly becoming America's game, a game that, you spent your Sundays watching. Basketball didn't have any of that. And the NBA didn't have any of that. There was no tradition to speak of. There was no characteristics that made you think of, hey, when I think of basketball, I think of, being with my dad, watching the Knicks or watching the Kings or whomever. There was nothing like that. As I said earlier, rather ineloquently, I think there was a real problem with perception. There were a lot of black players. And at the time, mainstream America was not exactly on board with blacks in big roles in entertainment or in society. It was an era where blacks were still considered to be militant. They were considered to be outspoken. It was not something that was, it was not a good era or not a productive era for the NBA, because there was this stigma, this unfair stigma, I should say, about the black athlete. So in the mid-1970s into the late 1970s and beyond, I think, there was a major problem. There was the NBA didn't have a tradition because it was only 30 years old, and no one had cultivated a tradition or an image for the NBA. And the NBA also had few, if any, stars that Ma and Pa America could relate to. So that was the NBA state in the mid to 1970s. It was a sport that was looking for an identity and looking for an audience.
Right. Yeah. A pre-Cosby show, right?
Yeah,
I think our generation, younger generations, don't understand how absent African Americans were from mainstream American culture.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, I mean that's a big point. I mean, you have to remember, We're both the same age. So in the 1980s, the mid-1980s, you had Eddie Murphy coming, who is, you know, a huge movie star. I think people forget how big a movie star Eddie Murphy was. You had Bill Cosby before, you know, right. before his awful behavior was revealed, and you have Michael Jackson, the same thing. You know, these men all came along in the early to mid 1980s. Before that, there really wasn't anything like that. There really wasn't an African American star who had that kind of crossover appeal. And there certainly wasn't any basketball star who had that mainstream appeal, especially before 1976, when Julius Erving comes onto the scene. So yeah, the NBA was really in a bind. I don't think it's an understatement to say that the NBA was, if it wasn't on death's door, it was maybe walking down that hallway.
Right. Wow. Yeah, and as you pointed out in the book, I think if there was one crossover star, maybe, you know, pre-1980s, maybe it was O.J. Simpson.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Another guy who the bottom kind of fell out there. But anyway, you know, Pete, you really pulled me into this book in the introduction when you talk about, you know, you get right into the kind of the oversimplified narrative of Bird, Magic, Sturt, Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
And I love how you wrote that as if it was one word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm a huge fan of basketball and basketball history, and even I have, you know, had fallen victim to that narrative. I think it's something that as people and as a society, we tend to do with movements of any kind. Mm-hmm. You know, I taught U.S. history for a few years, and I was always struck by that when I taught the civil rights movement, and I tried to impart that on my students. You know, we taught it, and even in the textbook, it was very much Rosa, Martin, Malcolm.
Yep.
You know, and that was, bam, civil rights movement. And I always tried to explain that there were larger social, economic, political issues and movements and forces at stake that drove that to a large extent. And I think you did a great job of capturing that in the book. You know, I used to say to my students, I said, if Dr. King had come along 50 years earlier, he may have had a substantial impact in the African American mm-hmm. community and maybe even beyond, but he wasn't getting the civil rights laws passed. He wasn't getting the voting rights laws passed. There were a lot of other forces at play. Mm-hmm. And the same thing could be said about Michael Jordan. Had he come along, say, 25 years earlier, it was just a different world.
Sure.
Coincidentally, I think a common thread with both of them is the explosion of television in different ways.
But, yeah.
So I want to talk about some of those forces, absolutely. But I do want to talk about a couple of the individuals because they were so important. And I'd like to start with somebody I didn't know a great deal about, and that's Larry O'Brien. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about his impact on the league.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought Larry O'Brien up because I think he is – He doesn't get enough credit for putting the NBA on its path. And I think a lot of this book deals with optics and marketing and how and the look of things. Larry O'Brien doesn't enjoy David Stern's reputation as an NBA commissioner. And with good reason, because David Stern, I'm sure we'll get into this later, he played such a role in turning the NBA into an international force. But what Larry O'Brien did was, he gave the league in 1975, he gave the league respectability. Larry O'Brien, for those who don't know him, and I quite frankly, I didn't know a lot about him either before I started writing this book and researching it. Larry O'Brien was a Democratic icon. He's an icon in the Democratic Party. He basically helped JFK reach national prominence. He was part of the Irish Mafia, the JFK's inner circle that were his advisors and the men that made him JFK. So Larry O'Brien brought JFK to the White House. When JFK was assassinated, he was part of the Lyndon B. Johnson's administration. And then after that, he was chairman of the Democratic National Party for, I think, two terms. So he was a big deal in the nation's political fabric. He was as Pat Williams, the GM of the 76ers, told me, he was a big deal. It was a big deal to get Larry O'Brien. So when Larry O'Brien takes this job as NBA commissioner in 1975, it's almost a step down for him. You know, now, I mean, becoming NBA commissioner now, or the commissioner in any of the major sports, that's a feather in your cap. That is a career highlight. Back in 1975, that wasn't the case. The NBA had to practically beg Larry O'Brien to take the job. So when Larry O'Brien comes in, the NBA gets an infusion of gravitas, which it desperately needed. It needed somebody who meant business. So even though Larry O'Brien didn't do nearly as much as David Stern, there were two things that he did. First was this image of respect. The second thing was he hired David Stern, who was outside counsel for the NBA for a number of years. He hired David Stern to work for the NBA, and he gave David Stern full reign to do what to act how he wanted to do. So Larry O'Brien could be the figurehead. He could be the person who came in and sat down negotiations, and he was crucial in getting the ABA to quote unquote merge with the NBA. But I think Larry O'Brien's biggest asset was he hired David Stern full time, and he basically let David Stern run wild. So while Larry O'Brien was doing the things that a CEO would do as the face of the company, David Stern was making sure the television contracts were fair. He was meeting with folks at USA Network to make sure that the coverage was perfect. He was hiring people to set up the next wave of leadership. He was hiring Rick Welts, who's now, I believe he's the CEO of the Warriors. He was hiring Bill Marshall, who turned NBA Apparel into this giant marketing cog in the NBA's machine. So Larry O'Brien's role in the ascension of the NBA cannot be overstated. Even though you don't read much about him, even though he is very much, I think, a footnote in the NBA's history, his role in what the NBA is now is absolutely crucial.
Yeah, I have to say, after reading the book, I felt a little better about him having the trophy named after him.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think he doesn't get enough credit. And I've said this to other people. We've all worked for bosses who want to take the credit, who are egomaniacs, who micromanage. Larry O'Brien's greatest asset was that he let people that were talented do the work. He trusted them to get things done. And he did that with not only David Stern, both Russ Granick, who was the deputy commissioner for many years. So the two of that, so that's a great gift as a leader. If you can say, all right, well, you know what, this person here is really, really good at these things that I either don't have time for, or I don't fully understand, or I'm not really interested in. So I'm going to let these people do their thing, and I'm going to handle the things that I know how to do or that I want to do. And Larry, I mean, and that's really is, if you think about it, that's a pretty good skill to have.
Yeah, absolutely. So you brought up David Stern, and mm-hmm. and we have to talk about him because
yes, we do.
I mean, not only was he so influential and important to the history of the league, mm-hmm. But I find him to be a fascinating figure. Somebody needs to write the definitive biography of David Stern one day.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, I guess, his vision for the league and how he went about implementing it.
Yeah, and I agree with you about David Stern. I think a biography would be an amazing read. Excuse me. Unfortunately, he's not going to. He was never going to write his memoirs, even before he passed away. That was never on his agenda. Anyway, about David Stern's vision. He saw the league as more than just a basketball league. He saw the league as something, as the best way I can put it is that he saw it as a machine with a ton of cogs working in concert. So, you know, it didn't, the NBA just couldn't be a top-down organization. It couldn't have one person ruling over everything. Everyone had to work together. So the players had to work with the league. They had to work with the owners. And that meant everything. It meant everything from, I think, from the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement, the drug deal in 1983, the drug policy, but also marketing, apparel. All there had to be synergy. There had to be cooperation, especially when the NBA was on such fragile footing for so many years. So but more than that, he saw the league as being an entertainment entity. A great phrase I think that was said to me by Arlene Weltman, who has worked at the NBA for a number of years. She said, you know, at one point, you know, David called us into his office and he said, you know, you guys, you don't get it. You don't get it. We're Disney. So it wasn't just a basketball league. It was providing entertainment for the broadest possible audience. It was having the merchandise, the videotapes. It was having arenas that were really theme parks with performers and with fancy lights and with eternity, you know, and making it more than just a basketball game. So he understood that you have to attract the broadest possible audience. The diehards will be there no matter what. Diehards like you and me. I mean, we'll, I don't know about you, but if someone gave me tickets to an NBA game right now, I would sit on a folding chair with a cup of water and you know, and nothing else. I mean, I love the game. But for the people that are borderline fans, the people that are not sports fans, quote unquote, or basketball fans, they needed more. And they needed to go to a game that was going to be more than a game. It was going to be an event. It was going to be a spectacle. And David Stern understood that better than anybody, because he wasn't tied down to tradition. The NBA didn't have tradition. There wasn't, you know, it didn't have the shield like the NFL has. It didn't have the status of being America's pastime. David Stern could write his own ticket. And his ticket was, you know what? We are going to be entertainment. We are going to give the fans what they want, but we're also going to make this enjoyable to, again, the widest possible audience. And he could do that because, again, the league, there was nothing to lose. You know, there was nothing to lose at the NBA. I mean, you could, if you worked at the NBA in the early 80s, mid 1980s, even in the late 1980s, if you had an idea, it was fair game. Try it out. There was no such thing as tradition. And the one thing David Stern hated to hear was, this is how we've always done it. If that was an excuse for why they're not doing something. To him, that was inexcusable. If an idea had credit, if an idea worked, or an idea had merit, go for it. And you know what? If it doesn't work, guess what? We'll try something new. So, and the NBA, I think, has that reputation to this day. If you look at the bubble, I think if you look at how baseball and football have handled the pandemic, it's very much been. In a way that is, how do I even put it? There's no imagination to it. There's no flexibility. With the NBA, the bubble was ingenious because it not only did it keep everyone safe, which was the top priority, but I think it also went against the tradition. You know, oh, we're gonna have home games and we're gonna travel and we're gonna put everyone in a bubble. This is how it's gonna work. And we're just gonna deal with it. So the NBA to this day, as a source told me, is always about pushing things to the cutting edge, pushing, not adhering to tradition. And that started with David Stern and continues to this day.
Yeah, I think that was very well said.
Oh, thanks.
I want to ask you about the ABA. I love the ABA. You know, Terry Pluto's Loose Balls is such a classic book, and I love learning about the history of that league. So I want to ask you, what impact do you think the ABA-NBA, as you said in quotes, merger had on the NBA?
Oh, it's huge. It was absolutely huge. I still think the ABA doesn't get its due. It's funny. I think Who did I talk to? Well, I think Julius Erving mentioned that he was, I think to this day, Julius Erving is still angry that his points from the ABA don't count toward his official points total. He's very upset about that. I think there was an article in the New York Times a few years ago where he talked about that. But I'm going off track. To me, the ABA's absorption into the NBA is absolutely critical to the NBA we see today, for a few reasons. First, the ABA was all about entertaining the fans. I mean, if you read Loose Balls, which is an amazing book, and I urge everybody who is listening to this podcast to read Loose Balls after you read my book, or before, it's your preference. But anyway, the ABA, you know, had these crazy halftime acts. They had, you know, they had ball girls in bikinis. They had all these weird, wonderful, quirky things because they had to get fans into the arenas. But beyond that, they also had a few great innovations. They had the 3-point line. And what the 3-point line did was not only, you know, add more points to the game, but it also opened the game up. So players like George Gervin and Julius Erving could take it to the hoop and be imaginative and do all these things on the open floor. I mean, the ABA was a run and gun game. So you had, you know, a lot of taking to the hole. You didn't have a lot of big men. So there wasn't the low post play that the NBA was in love with at the time. The ABA was all run and gun, fast breaks, 3-pointers, and also just, you know, finding imaginative ways to put the ball in the hole. So you have that style of play, but not only that, you have these players. You have a great crop of players coming in, and it's not just Julius Erving and George Gervin. You have Dan Issel, Bobby Jones, Maurice Lucas, Artis Gilmore, James Silas. I could go on, George McGinnis. I could go on and on. So you have all these young, and that's the appropriate word here, young, exciting players who come into the NBA in 1976, and they set the tone. And they also, and Howard Bryan pointed this out to me when I talked to him, Julius Erving's arrival also made stylistic basketball acceptable. I mean, that's the important thing. All these guys coming in, headlined by Julius Erving, made stylistic basketball, which is, you know, the dunks and the razzle dazzle, that made that normal in the NBA. So you cannot underestimate how important the ABA's arrival was to the NBA, because it gave it an infusion of young talent. It introduced a style of play that you still see to this day, especially with the 3-point shot. You know, I don't think any team that doesn't rely on the 3-point shot as part of their strategy, they're going to be in the lottery come June. But those are the big things. I mean, the 3-point line, obviously, the style of play, the players, and yeah, I'm trying to think. I mean, those are the three big things. I think those are, I'm going off the rails here, but, the ABA was absolutely crucial to the NBA. I mean, I think you can even say that the ABA saved the NBA. You know, I mean, there's, wow. You know, there's, because again, I mean, if you don't have Julius Erving, who then becomes the ambassador for the league for so many years before before Bird and Magic arrive, that's another important component of this too, was just how important Julius Erving was to the NBA, who needed a matinee idol, because he was their matinee idol for a number of years.
Yeah. And I love, there's a great line in the book, about Dr. J, and I hope I get this right, but sure. it was basically, I think a reporter asked, I think it was Butch Beard, why Julius Erving didn't have the same impact as Michael Jordan, and the answer was television.
Yeah.
And that's a great way to segue into, could you talk a little bit about what was television coverage of the NBA like in the, say, in, you know, the early 80s, late 70s or early 80s, and how did that change over the next decade?
It was uninventive in the early 1980s. It was very, very staid. And what prompted the change in coverage was, in 1982, CBS Sports renews the NBA contract reluctantly. It wasn't something they were particularly enthused to do. But at the time, Neil Pilson, who's then the president of CBS Sports, gives hands over the telecast of the NBA to a young producer named Ted Shaker. And Ted Shaker sees an opportunity with the coverage. He doesn't want to do the same old stuff. So what he does is just, I think, doesn't get talked about enough. He basically turns the NBA, these NBA games, into events. So what they do is they schedule, tries to make it relevant. So they do a few things with that. So what do they do? First, with the Sunday slate of games, those games feature at least two of the following four players: Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, or Dr. J. So that's the first thing. They go with stars because the NBA at that time, again, was still finding its footing. So Ted Shaker and the CBS Sports guys say, all right, you know, we're gonna focus on the stars. That's number one. Number two is they start turning the NBA games into events. They put the NBA on before the Daytona 500, the Super Bowl. And CBS Sports could do that because they had everything at the time. They were probably the preeminent sports television network at the time. I mean, ESPN was barely a year or two old. USA Network wasn't really a force at that time. So that's the important thing. They offered those games as sort of, I guess, pregame appetizers to big events like the Daytona 500. And the third thing I should mention is they treat the games as entertainment. They don't treat the games as just, all right, well, there's a jump shot, scores down 48-46, 2 minutes to go. They turn the games into events. And that's everything from the introduction, which has this razzly dazzly computer graphics introduction, which at the time is truly inventive, but now looks a little rinky dink. They do it by hiring folks like Pat O'Brien to offer this really irreverent, personality-driven halftime report, which I think was extremely popular. They hire Tommy Heinsohn, who doesn't want to treat the games as straight up television. You know, he tells them, like, you know, treat this as a murder mystery. You know, offer clues, don't show everything. And they have CBS uses a director named Sandy Grossman, who shows the emotion of the games. Like, he'll show Larry Bird waving a towel. He'll show Michael Cooper crumpling to the floor after the Rockets beat them in that great Western Conference Finals series in '86. So again, that you are not appealing to diehards here. You are making these games appealing to a broad audience, and it worked. It worked marvelously because the games were treated as theater. And they were treated as you weren't just plopped into a game. The games were treated as, well, almost like a news event. You know, Dick Stockton and Tommy Heinsohn would come on, and they would tell you exactly what you needed to know. They would fill you in. So then you're watching the game at home, and like, okay, I get this. Like, there's the Celtics have Bird, but they also have McHale and Parrish. Oh, that's interesting. So that was absolutely key. It was all part of broadening the audience. And with CBS Sports, they could do just about. I'm sorry. With Ted Shaker and Sandy Grossman and all these men and women who worked on these NBA telecasts, they had free range because CBS Sports didn't really care. You know, the NBA wasn't a big entertainment property for them. It was football was their bread and butter. So Ted Shaker and Sandy Grossman and all of these men and women, they could do whatever they wanted to, and they did, and it worked great.
Right. All right, Pete, it was a matter of time. We have to get into Michael Jordan.
Oh, no, I was a Knicks fan in the early 90s, so this is horrible. But
I'm right there with you, man. Anyway, you know, David, I love this analogy where, you know, you've talked about so far how David Stern, you know, really envisioned the NBA as a major entertainment venue, right, center. And, of course, used the comparison to Disney World, yes, in the book, which I found fascinating. Mm-hmm. And as you say in the book, in 1984, David Stern got his Mickey Mouse, yep, in Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. So what made Michael Jordan such a transcendent star?
Well, I mean, obviously he could play. I mean, that was the first thing. Yeah. he was amazing. I mean, I think Bob Ryan or Bill Simmons mentions, you know, he passes the eye test, or he, you know, where if like anyone, like if an alien went, came down and saw Michael Jordan play, they would just be amazed by him. But it wasn't just that. I mean, Michael Jordan, I think from the time he left the University of North Carolina, I do think that he was a extremely, extremely shrewd and smart business person. He was somebody who knew exactly what he could do. He was someone who knew that the cameras were on. He knew what the media wanted. He knew what everyone wanted. There's a great story I didn't get a chance to include in the book, but at one point, the NBA entertainment crew, which was the NBA's in-house video and highlights arm, were filming Michael Jordan for a piece on the golf course. So they're driving around and Michael Jordan is like pointing to his chest. And the producer is like, what's this? And Michael Jordan says, your mic isn't connected. So he knew exactly like what was expected of him. He knew what the stakes were. He had the savvy, he had the playing ability, but he also comes about at the right time. You mentioned before about how the NBA was perceived at the time. By the mid 1980s, you have these wave of popular black entertainers that are on the scene with folks like Eddie Murphy and Michael Jackson, Bill Cosby, and Michael Jordan comes along right at that time. So there's that point too. And the other thing too is he was just such a good looking dude. You know, in David Halberstam's book on Michael Jordan, Playing for Keeps, he describes Michael Jordan as beautiful several times. Like several times, hi, sweetie, how are you? Good, okay. I'll see you soon, okay, hon? All right, I love you. Bye. That was my daughter. Michael Jordan is described as being beautiful several times, and he was. There's an anecdote in the book where when he was introduced as Gatorade's pitchman, there was a meeting at Quaker Oats, and all the women in the crowd were crowded in the front row just to get close to Michael Jordan because he was just so attractive. So you have the style of play, which is great. He comes along at the perfect time. You have the fact that he is an attractive, charismatic man. And I'm trying to think, you have those three things.
He had style too.
He had definitely had style.
The bald head even became huge.
Yeah.
He had a kind of, as you say, you know, in the book a little bit, almost a little rebellious streak in that, you know, this is, I'm going to do things my way. And I think that appealed to a lot of people.
Right. But he was rebellious, but also he was stridently apolitical. Like, you know, if you think about players before him who were great, Bill Russell was really into black activism at that time. He was outspoken. He was a trailblazer. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was not only, you know, was a Muslim. That was not really, to this day, is a religion that I don't think a lot of people understand or they reject, which is foolish. But he also wasn't great with the media. He wasn't approachable. Michael Jordan was somebody who, you didn't really know his political beliefs. You didn't know that he was just someone, I think, you could just assign whatever you wanted to him. So if you're a kid, you see the bald head, you see the baggy shorts, you see the dunks, that attracts you. If you're a basketball fan, the style of play just takes you out of your seat. But there was nothing really objectionable to him. There wasn't anything that made you say, oh, you know, that Michael Jordan, aside from me, the bald head and the baggy shorts, he was very middle of the road. So that really worked well for him. There was nothing, you know, he never went, I don't think he ever really talked about, you know, how he felt about being, I mean, not that I could see in the research, but he didn't really reveal how he was feeling. He wasn't really someone who would talk on end about how he felt being, you know, being young and being such a celebrity or being black in America. He was very much just Michael Jordan, the same way you talk about, you know, I don't know, like you know, a desk lamp or a cup. Like that's just, he's just there. Okay. It's Michael Jordan. Right. So I don't know. I suspect, because I think Michael Jordan is extremely bright. I think he knew exactly how he wanted to be perceived. And there's another anecdote in the book. And again, Paul, cut me off if I'm rambling here.
But, yeah, go ahead. That's great.
But there's an anecdote in the book, when I wrote it down, I was just, oh my God, this is great. That I think really reveals how aware Michael Jordan was of who he was and what his influence was. So in the late 1990s, the Bulls are in the middle of their third three-peat. And Michael Jordan now is probably, if not the biggest sports star in America, he might be the biggest star in America. So he's in Los Angeles filming on an off day a commercial for Nike. And it was very hush-hush. It was kept under wraps. It was actually filmed, I think, in the tunnel underneath the Great Western Forum. So Nike only has a very short period of time to get this commercial done, film him, get him out of there. So they film the commercial, they're getting him out of there, and of course, word gets out. There's a huge crowd. Michael! So Jordan is with a gentleman named Scott Bedbury, who is a very prominent Nike executive, now a very big very big deal in business circles. Very nice guy. That's beside the point. Anyway, so Scott Bedbury is with Michael Jordan, and Scott is in charge of getting him into the limousine to get him back to the hotel because like the time is ticking. And Jordan's agent was David Falk, who was very much business minded and knew what he was doing. So basically, if they go over time, like Nike is gonna be paying perhaps millions more to have Michael Jordan's time. So anyway, time is really tight. So Michael Jordan is emerging from the tunnel. Michael, he goes in the crowd, starts signing autographs. 5 minutes pass. Scott Bedbury is like, Mike, we have to go. Just a minute. Michael, keep signing. 5 more minutes pass. Scott Bedbury at this point is like, yeah, we are against the clock. If we get him back late, we are screwed. Scott Bedbury finally says, Michael, we have to go now. We gotta go. So before leaving, Michael Jordan just gazes into the crowd for 20 seconds, 30 seconds, and then heads back into the limousine. Limousine takes off. Scott Bedbury says, Michael, what was that about? Did you miss something? Did you forget something? What's going on? And Michael Jordan says, no, it's just that when I'm in a crowd, I want to make sure that someone gets a chance to look at me because they may not see me again. I want to make sure that I want to make sure that someone gets to see me. That if I'm there, they know that I'm there. That is a remarkably observant thing to say. And I think that shows just how aware Michael Jordan was of his impact and of his prominence. So really, David Stern had the perfect partner with for his quest to fulfill the NBA's vision, because I think Michael Jordan knew what his marketability was. And, you know, I think that is something that maybe doesn't get talked about enough. Just how aware he was as a celebrity. And I don't know, he might be the first athlete to be aware of his role in the new media landscape.
Right. That's interesting. It reminds me, the way you're describing it, his awareness, it's a different time, yeah, a different media, mm-hmm, but of Joe DiMaggio is, yes, much like that.
Yeah. DiMaggio. That's who I was thinking. I mean, DiMaggio was the same way. I mean, you didn't really know much about him. He wasn't going to talk to many people. And I think he had the same great line about, you know, I always try my best because it might be the first time someone seeing me play. Right. And you know, I think Jordan understood that, and very much Jordan and DiMaggio post sports career, I think, have the same sort of mysterioso profile. Like, you know them, but you don't really know them. You know, yeah, right.
I mean, there's Gatorade, Michael. You know, Mr. Coffee DiMaggio, mm-hmm, but yeah,
and that's, you know, and again, that's one reason why. Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, there's an aura around them, and not too many people are going to pierce that, for sure.
Right. One thing I have to ask you about is kind of the marriage between hip hop and hoops.
Yes.
You know, and I think, you know, Marvin Gaye wasn't a hip hop artist. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, mm-hmm. more R&B, but I think that was really, you know, as you depict in the book, really kind of his legendary performance at the 1983 All-Star Game. And if anybody hasn't seen that, please watch that after this. It's beautiful.
Please.
It was really a pivotal moment for the league. Mm-hmm. And even though it wasn't hip hop per se, I think, you know, it maybe started that pairing, or was at least influential in that pairing between, I don't know what you want to call it, urban music or African-American music mm-hmm. and basketball. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I'm happy to. To me, that is the pivotal moment in the NBA, in the creation of the NBA that we see today. Because wow. here is somebody who is performing a non-traditional rendition of basically a war song. I mean, let's call it what it is. So he's turning this song that we've just endured for ages into this soulful, almost danceable music. But what's more important about that is that it's representative of who's playing the game at that moment. And it's mostly African Americans, mostly black men. So the NBA, I mean, didn't plan this. It was not something they designed. But Marvin Gaye's rendition is an open admission, like, and again, it's completely coincidental, but it's an inadvertent open admission, I guess, that this is who we are. This is who we are. This is representative of the NBA. It is a sport that is going to do things differently. It's a sport that embraces who is on the floor, meaning black men who are not kowtowing to the quote unquote traditional American values, however you want to define them. We are young, we are hip, we are cool, we are black, deal with it. And that from that point on, I think everything, the NBA rounds the corner and embraces itself as a quote unquote cool sport. And because again, if you look at it after that point in 1984, David Stern becomes commissioner. Okay. Rap is starting to really make huge inroads. The players are younger. They're embracing hip hop culture. They're embracing that music. The fans are embracing that music. And the NBA realizes that, you know what, to appeal to the young fans who we want to court, we are going to embrace this music. So that's why you see Kid and Play at NBA All-Star Weekend. That's why it becomes like sort of this hip hop, the All-Star Game weekend becomes sort of this hip hop hangout for music executives, artists, everybody. That anthem to me is absolutely crucial in the formation of the NBA that we see today. And whether you like the anthem or hate the anthem, and believe me, there are people who hate it, and they hated it then, they hate it now. That is the springboard for the NBA that you see today, in my opinion.
Right. All right, Pete. Well, I know you need to go soon, so I'll get you. I have one last question.
Sure,
I'll get you out of here.
Sure.
Let me just say one last time. Pete's book is called From Hang Time to Prime Time, Business, Entertainment, and the Birth of the Modern Day NBA. Guys, I can't recommend this book highly enough. Me as an amateur NBA historian just ate it up, but there's stuff in here for everybody. If you're interested in the entertainment industry, if you're interested in hip hop, if you're interested in business in general and the growth of a business and how to go about that, you know, this is a fascinating book. It's Pete interviewed over 300 people for this project, and the breadth and the depth of it is just remarkable. So I definitely go out and get this book. As I said, Pete, one last question I'd like to ask all my guests. What mm-hmm. is your all-time favorite sports book?
Oh, geez. Oh, man. That is...
I know it's tough to pick one.
It is. I mean, Oh boy. I mean, I'm sitting here in my office, and behind me I have, you know, I have a floor to ceiling bookcase, and I could probably just rattle off, you know, it's just stocked with great sports books. Boy, that is a hell of a question. I think my brain might explode with with this. I mean, seriously. I mean,
we don't want that to happen.
No, the book just came out, so I'd like to savor it for a little bit longer. Let me take a look here. You know what? I'm gonna go a little offbeat here, because I'm gonna go with the sports book that got me interested in sports books. I know that might be kind of a cop out, but
no,
I
no, that's cool.
Yeah, I think, but to me, it's I want to go with what got me here, and to me, my choice is Xander Hollander's Pro Basketball Handbook,
all right,
1991.
Oh, specific year. Okay.
Yeah, because that got me into basketball. That got me, I was just getting into basketball at the time. And it was so, I was a baseball fan before. So I'd read the Xander Hollander Pro Baseball Handbooks, which came out year after year. I think I read five or six of them. And then I read the Pro Basketball Handbook. And that blew my mind. The writing in those books, and I'm trying to think who wrote. I can't remember who wrote the scouting reports and the previews, but it just exploded with wit and insight and color, and I can't explain just how influential those books were. They made me excited to read. They made me excited to read. I read that book until it split in half. So the book was just, I mean, I read, these were for those who don't know, these handbooks, which came out every year in the four major sports, they were an invaluable resource before the internet, because there was nothing you could really find that had everything in one spot. So I read that book until it split in half, literally. And I mean, I would actually read one half, then read the other. And I think that's what really gave me a hard shove to learning about basketball, or the NBA rather, reading about basketball more, reading about it. Those books are just, even the baseball books too, are extremely influential to me. And it always bothers me when someone says, "Oh, well, you know, you're reading, is this a sports book? Oh, you're reading a sports book." Well, you know, for the 8-year-old kid who's reading those Xander Hollander handbooks, or who's reading Matt Christopher, or who's reading the sports pages, that's their introduction to reading. That is their launching pad. And some of the best writing I've read, period, is from sports books. Like I'm looking right here at my bookshelf. You're telling me that Roger Engel isn't on par with some of the best nonfiction writers on the planet? You're telling me that, I don't know, I'm looking at Howard Bryant's Shutout where is Howard's other book?
You mentioned Halberstam.
Yeah, Halberstam.
I mean, a couple of his books.
Yeah. I mean, Howard Bryant's the Heritage. Like, you're telling me those books don't cover big ideas and have eloquent writing and make you see the world in a different way or expand your worldview? It's funny. I've gotten, if you read the acknowledgments, I know you have, like, it kind of sounds like a deathbed speech, because I'm thanking like everybody and their uncle. But there are so many, I mean, there are not only so many people who helped me get this book out, and I'm sure you've written your own book, and I'm dying to read it. I'm sure you can say the same thing. There's so many people who helped you,
yeah.
But there are also so many books that just made me want to read, and so many of them are sports books, and so many of them are just aspirational models. I mean, I think if you're a journalism student, or even if you're a fan of great writing, if you read David Halberstam's books on the NBA. They're a masterclass on story, structure, reporting. If you read any of Jeff Perlman's books, they are a testament to just digging and finding and just finding the nugget. So yeah, I mean, it is, it really is. To me, sports books have made me who I am for better or for worse. And not only that, they opened my mind to great reading, but they've helped me branch off into other reading too. I mean, I don't just read sports books. I read a pretty wide variety of things. And, to me, I mean, that's the foundation. So for anyone who discounts sports books or discounts their value to an active, healthy reading appetite, I don't understand it. And I probably never will.
Amen, my man. Amen. That's all I can say. Beautiful.
Thank you.
Well said. All right. Well, you got to go be a daddy. So I'm going to let you go, my friend.
All right. Well, Paul, this was great. Thank you so much for the kind words. It truly means a lot. And for having me on. This is a real treat. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. It was a pleasure for me as well.
All right, sir. Take care.
All right. Take care and good luck with the book.
Thank you, sir. Yours as well.